rule of law and the way that a democracy operates is to make sure that the laws are enforced equally for all people, not just those who can afford an attorney.
Federal budget cuts threaten to zero out Alaska legal services. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, March 22nd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, for the first time in 3 decades, Yukon Kuskokwim residents will be able to hunt emperor geese.
There are many people that are working frantically to get it through the review stages and the signatures that are necessary and get it published.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
When you pick Click Give, you become a partner with a local nonprofit working to protect the things you love about Alaska. Whether it's the arts, our parks, or lending a hand to someone in crisis, with Pick Click Give, it's easy to find a nonprofit that shares your passion or provides programs in your neighborhood. When you apply for your PFD, say yes to sharing just $25 or more of your dividend. If you've already filed, add a donation at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by Pick Click Give.
For the past 50 years, Alaska Legal Services Corporation has offered free legal help to low-income Alaskans. Cases have ranged from private matters like guardianship designations and protective orders to statewide issues like building schools in rural Alaska. President Trump's budget blueprint eliminates federal funding for legal services programs nationwide. Alaska Public Media's Ann Hillman learned what that could mean for Alaskans.
Alaska Legal Services Corporation started offering help with civil legal issues in 1967. Back then, volunteer lawyers fresh out of law school were sent around the state to work on cases like adoptions, divorces, and native land claims. One of the first was Chris Cook, who arrived in Kotzebue in 1968.
I don't think there'd ever been a lawyer living in the community before who was accessible to people.
He says the community taught him about life in the Northwest Arctic, and together they figured out the laws of the new state. Eventually, Cook moved to Bethel to work as a paid staff attorney with the nonprofit, and he started looking into issues around schooling. The state didn't provide high schools in rural communities because of the cost, so students were forced to choose between leaving their families or stopping their education.
You know, the system made a certain amount of sense from a cost standpoint, but from a human standpoint, it didn't.
He was one of the original lawyers on the Molly Hooch case in 1972, which led eventually to a settlement with the state and the construction of rural schools.
Sometimes you're just serving the direct immediate needs of an individual client that comes into your office, but sometimes serving those needs can also have a broader impact.
The nonprofit and its 12 offices around the state serve about 6,000 low-income Alaskans every year. They turn away half of the applicants who seek help because of a lack of funding. Just over a fifth of the organization's $5 million annual budget comes from the federally funded Legal Services Corporation. This year's White House budget proposal cuts funding for the Legal Service Corporation across the nation. The cut is promoted by the Heritage Foundation, a D.C.-based conservative think tank. Last year, Legal Services Corporation received $385 million. ALSC Executive Director Nicole Nelson says the cut could have a significant impact in Alaska.
That's our backbone core funding, and we use it to leverage the additional resources, which are helping keeping our rural offices open.
Nelson explains that unlike in criminal cases, in civil matters, people don't have a constitutional right to legal representation. They have to find it themselves, but many can't afford to pay an attorney. Nelson says eliminating assistance options is unjust.
The rule of law and the way that a democracy operates is to make sure that the laws are enforced equally for all people, not just those who can afford an attorney.
One of the people who turned to ALSC this past year was Hilda Jacobs, who needed custody of her 12-year-old grandson, Aiden. At her home in East Anchorage, Jacobs walks slowly through her living room, oxygen cord dragging behind her. Her scoliosis reduced her lung capacity.
It's hard to get around. It takes me a hard time to catch my breath.
But she gets by, she says, in part because of her grandson.
I'm very proud of him. He's my baby. He doesn't like to be called that.
Jacobs has raised Aiden on and off since he was little, But without legal custody, it was hard to get him to medical appointments or give him permission for activities at school. She says his mother lives across town and doesn't have the means to care for him. Jacobs is on disability and couldn't afford a lawyer on her own. So last May, she sought the help of ALSC to get full custody of the boy. The process was finalized this winter. She says, without ALSC...
I wouldn't have been able to get custody of him. And that would have broke my heart.
The organization also helps coordinate pro bono services with private attorneys and has AmeriCorps volunteers stationed at Native hospitals and clinics around the state. In Anchorage, I'm Ann Hillman.
After 30 years of waiting and conserving, residents of the Yukon-Kuskokwim region will be able to hunt emperor geese again next month. Wildlife managers and hunters are standing by for the federal government to release the official notice. As KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur reports, residents will then continue a tradition that skipped a generation.
Most of the communities out in the villages, they are primarily subsistence lifestyle, and all the species that our parents once knew and consumed when they were growing from young age, we are about to start tasting.
The last time Roland White of Tuntutuliak tasted emperor goose, he was about 10 years old, when his father brought home game from the tundra. Now White is the chairman of the Association of Village Council Presidents Waterfowl Conservation Committee.
Like any other birds or mammals or fish, they sustain our livelihood and our entity as Alaska Natives.
Soon, White will be able to bring home the emperor geese like his father did before him, passing the tradition down to the generation that missed it. The AVCP Waterfowl Conservation Committee met Monday with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service biologists to hear an update on the expected hunt. Eric Taylor with the service told the group the regulation booklets are already at the printer, ready for when the official notice gets published in the Federal Register. It's expected any day.
There are many people that are working frantically to get it through the review stages and the signatures that are necessary and get it published.
For 30 years, Alaska residents abstained from hunting emperor geese after the population dropped to dangerously low levels in the 1980s. After decades of allowing the bird population to rise, tribes began asking for a hunt. Together, tribal groups, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and the Alaska Department of Fish and Game created a co-management plan. Now, the subsistence hunt is expected to open April 2nd, with no limit on bag or possession. A restricted winter hunt should follow. The emperor goose population hits about 170,000. That's just above the threshold to sustain a hunt. Managers like Eric Taylor are encouraging conservative hunting. He says just as the generation of humans may have never tasted emperor geese, so too the geese have forgotten what it was like to be hunted.
They see folks in a blind with these things that look like long sticks that are actually shotguns. They're not going to know that people are actually harvesting birds. They're going to be naive, I guess, if it's such a term to say for a bird.
Emperor geese have other traits that make them vulnerable to overharvesting. When one gets shot, the flock doesn't fly away, but instead circles back. Birds lay eggs later in life and don't lay every year, and the rates for the birds living past their first year is lower than other geese species. Managers have suggestions for how to prevent overharvest and keep the population growing. Limit how many birds a hunter takes. Only take juvenile birds with dark heads as opposed to adult birds with white heads that could be breeding. Target one bird at a time instead of spraying the flock, and to only take one or two eggs from a nest. The Kodiak Alaska Migratory Bird Co-Management Council is recommending its members harvest only one bird or what they need during the subsistence season. The Association of Village Council Presidents Waterfowl Conservation Committee has not recommended a restriction for its members. In Bethel, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
A software update error locked thousands of state employees out of their work computers earlier today. Roughly 6,000 state workers were unable to log into their computers this morning, affecting 2 in 5 executive branch workers. Department of Administration officials say it was caused by human error while a security update was being installed. State Chief Information Technology Officer Jim Steele says the state quickly identified the root cause of the problem. It took a few hours for those affected to be able to log on again.
It looks like error, and we are working to correct this as soon as we possibly can. It's one of those issues that once the fix has been identified, it actually takes a while to work its way through the network.
Department of Administration Deputy Commissioner Leslie Rydell says the incident didn't appear to cause any critical trouble.
We didn't hear any problems with anything emergency, like somebody couldn't perform an emergency function. We haven't heard that at all. But definitely, I'm sure people were inconvenienced.
Rydell says many workers were able to log in using the computers of coworkers that weren't affected. Computer technicians are expected to be working to unlock computers tonight and tomorrow. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the Environmental Protection Agency tells Fairbanks residents they must reduce local air pollution.
We are here to work collaboratively with our partners at the Department of Environmental Conservation and in the borough to address the challenge of achieving clean, healthy air.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com.
Older Persons Action Group publishes Senior Voice, Alaska's only statewide publication for seniors, and is an excellent source of information for families and caregivers. SeniorVoiceAlaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
The state is fining oil and gas company Hillcorp an additional $160,000 for using nitrogen without permission while working on two wells in 2015, the same practice that nearly killed three North Slope workers. Earlier this month, the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission fined Hillcorp $200,000 for the worker safety incident, which also happened in 2015. During that incident, the unauthorized use of nitrogen instead of water during a well cleanout caused three contractors to lose consciousness at the well site. In an emailed statement, Hillcorp spokeswoman Lori Nelson says the company has changed its safety practices in response to the incidents. She added Hillcorp doesn't agree with all the commission's findings, but the company also doesn't plan on appealing the latest fines. Hillcorp is also responsible for an ongoing natural gas leak from a pipeline fueling oil platforms in Cook Inlet. The company says it can't fix the leak until sea ice in the inlet subsides. Amidst a wave of new oil discoveries in Alaska, other companies are hoping to get lucky too. And in pursuit of the next billion barrel find, two companies from Texas and Australia are trying something a little different. Elizabeth Harbaugh from Alaska's Energy Desk has more.
After the state of Alaska's oil and gas lease sale in December, Burgundy Exploration CEO Paul Bozinski offered this explanation for the name of his big North Slope project.
Because it's called Burgundy, everything we do is about wine. That's why it's called ice wine, because it's cold up here, and I like German ice wine.
At the lease sale, held here in Anchorage, Texas-based Burgundy and its Australian partner 88 Energy picked up hundreds of thousands more acres on the North Slope to pursue Project Ice Wine. Bozinski was thrilled with the results.
We've now tied up what we believe to be very much of a world-class shale play.
That's what Project Ice Wine is all about, finding a world-class shale play in the Arctic. Unlike conventional oil discoveries like Prudhoe Bay, shale oil is harder to recover, requiring technology like hydraulic fracturing to get it out of the ground. But improvements to horizontal drilling and fracking technologies led to the recent oil and gas boom in the lower 48. Now, Bozinski hopes to bring the shale revolution to Alaska.
We believe that this is the future of the Arctic.
Another company is going after shale oil on the North Slope, Great Bear Petroleum. That company has been working to develop their leases since 2010. This week, 88 Energy announced they started setting up a rig on the North Slope to drill a second well for Project Ice Wine. In an interview with a financial news outlet last month, 88 Energy Managing Director Dave Wall said the well will help them figure out if there's enough accessible oil to make their project commercially viable.
It is crunch time, so Ice Wine 2 is a well that's designed to do a production test of our main play in our Alaskan asset. You know, really, this is the key event in terms of unlocking the value of this play.
88 Energy hopes to begin flow testing the well by June or July. Shortly after, the companies may know if they're sitting on the Arctic oil shale play of their dreams. But proving the oil is there is just the first step. There's a big reason the shale oil boom hasn't hit the North Slope already, explains Mark Myers, former Alaska Department of Natural Resources Commissioner. That reason is cost. Meyer says fracked wells
produce at high rates initially, but then decline very rapidly, which means you have to go back in and drill more wells. So shale development requires a much higher density of well bores than most conventional drilling. And that's more money, more pads, more roads and infrastructure.
This becomes a big issue on the environmentally sensitive North Slope, Meyer says, where companies must make costly investments on things like ice roads to protect the tundra. He says another challenge is that fracking requires lots of water and a way to dispose of that water once it's been used. Neither would be easy or cheap where Project Icewine is located. Although its main target is shale oil, 88 Energy has hinted it's possible they'll find conventional oil in Project Icewine territory too. Meyer says if the companies can get at the easier to recover oil, their unconventional pursuit is more likely to pencil out. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage.
Fairbanks North Star Borough residents have to find ways to burn less and cleaner to bring the community into compliance with federal air quality regulations. That's the message from Environmental Protection Agency representatives in Fairbanks this week to talk about chronic wintertime fine particulate pollution in some area neighborhoods. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
Speaking at a North Star Borough Air Pollution Control Commission meeting Tuesday, EPA Region 10 Air and Waste Director Tim Hamlin emphasized that government and the public have to solve the Fairbanks North Pole area fine particulate pollution problem together.
We are here to work collaboratively with our partners at the Department of Environmental Conservation and in the borough to address the challenge of achieving clean, healthy air and warm homes in the borough and in North Pole in particular. Right now, this week, is the time for us to be thinking broadly and creatively about what's going to work best.
Millions of dollars have already been spent to remove or replace over 2,000 polluting wood and coal stoves and boilers around the North Star Borough and to educate the public about clean burning practices. But some neighborhoods continue to see extreme spikes when inversions trap smoke at ground level. The borough is facing more stringent measures as it's reclassified a serious non-attainment area by the EPA. Local peak pollution readings, the worst in the U.S., present a major challenge, according to EPA air quality planner Justin Spinillo.
Definitely realize it's a difficult situation to balance out, you know, the need for people to breathe clean air, but also to keep their homes warm. So how do we balance that out? It's a situation we've seen, but the extreme nature of it is unique.
Spinillo outlined scenarios that have enabled communities in Oregon, Idaho, and Washington to come into compliance and says they all include similar components, most fundamentally, burn bans.
A commitment to a curtailment program, which is kind of the backbone of any good program that we've seen to effectively reduce PM from wood smoke.
The North Star Borough recently tightened existing burn ban rules, but Spinillo stresses that bans only work when there's strong community leadership and public buy-in, a challenge when heating is a major expense and wood is a local fuel source. During public testimony at Tuesday's meeting, Willow Leaves Doy Mission, representing Kids for Environmental Action, urged people to think beyond themselves.
You can have freedom, but it needs to stop when that freedom is starting to get into other people's property and hurting them.
Doy Mission says she's speaking up on behalf of friends suffering from asthma and other health problems related to fine particulate pollution.
A lot of other people can't wait till someday to get the air cleaned up. It has to be now.
EPA officials outlined a multi-year process to address the local air pollution problem, including assessment of economic impacts of control strategies. Officials highlighted a recently announced $2.5 million agency grant to fund a replacement of 600 outdated wood and coal stoves and boilers in North Star Borough neighborhoods suffering the worst pollution. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
One of the Sea Alaska Regional Native Corporation's longest serving leaders is stepping down. Rosita Worrell has spent 30 years on the Juneau-based corporation's board of directors. She says she's been thinking about leaving for a while.
I probably would have resigned 3 years ago,
But at that point in time, I was chair of the lands legislation, and I felt like I wanted to see that completed before I left the board.
That controversial bill traded corporate land near shareholder communities for more valuable timber properties within Southeast's Tongass National Forest. After several attempts, it passed Congress in 2014. Worrell says she will complete her final three-year board term, which ends in June. That will leave an open seat on Sealeska's board of directors to be filled during spring shareholder elections. In the past, many departing board members resigned during their terms and were replaced by an appointee who then ran as an incumbent. Worrell will continue as president of the Sealeska Heritage Institute, the corporation's cultural arm. The anthropologist, who's taught at the University of Alaska Southeast, says she's looking forward to completing some academic projects.
I've had to spend most of my energies on Sealeska and Sealeska Heritage Institute. And I'd like to finish a couple of manuscripts that I have, Tlingit property law and an INCSA study, for example.
Worrell of Juneau is one of the longest-serving members of Sealeska's 13-person corporate board. Only Albert Kukash of Angoon has served longer. Worrell's leadership roles have extended outside Southeast Alaska. She's been on the boards of the Alaska Federation of Natives, the Indigenous Languages Institute, and the National Museum of the American Indian. She's also chaired the Federal Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act Review Committee.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Anchorage and Fairbanks to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly.
An investigation has concluded that a fire that destroyed the main building at Ice, Alaska late last year originated in a heating system. Alaska State Troopers report the State Division of Fire and Life Safety says the December 16th blaze began in the chimney for an oil-fired boiler. The fire resulted in a total loss of the building, which served as the administrative center for Ice Alaska, as well as a public food service and warming area in Fairbanks. It was valued at $1.5 million. Ice Alaska has carried on this season with reconfigured on-site structures and tents. After a year-long push by concerned trail users, a ban on trapping within some public land in the Matanuska-Susitna Borough is now official. In a unanimous vote Tuesday night, the Borough Assembly approved the ban, which prohibits trapping in the borough-owned recreation areas and on school grounds. Assemblymember Dan Mayfield sponsored the new ordinance after hearing from the Alaska Safe Trails Group and receiving a petition with the signatures of more than 3,500 Matsu residents.
It's really providing people with a opportunity to recreate in a healthy environment without the stress of worrying about whether they or their animals or any family member whatsoever would be hurt from traps that are out there.
Mayfield says a few trappers gave public testimony at previous assembly meetings, explaining they felt the ordinance opened the door to further restrictions. Mayfield and borough officials say the trappers were vastly outnumbered by the residents in support of the ban at those same meetings.
You know, our population has grown to the point where we're the second largest municipality in the state of Alaska. We've got about 103,000 people, and they're bound to be conflicts with traditional Alaska land usage and a growing population. And certainly we have to resolve those conflicts.
Maps that show where trapping is now banned under the ordinance are available on the Matsu Borough's website, matsugov.us. It's been a chilly winter in Interior and elsewhere around the state, but for the Arctic Ocean, it's been one long warm spell. That's led to another record low year for formation of Arctic winter sea ice cover. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
Experts with the National Snow and Ice Data Center say formation of sea ice around the Arctic Ocean probably petered out about 2 weeks ago, and today they finally declared that the extent of sea ice cover on the Arctic Ocean has grown as much as it's going to this year.
What we have now is what we call the lowest maximum on record.
Mark Serez is a senior research scientist with the Snow and Ice Data Center. He says well above average warmth over the Arctic Ocean since fall has led to well below average sea ice formation. So much so that the center declared this year's Arctic sea ice maximum extent was the lowest in 38 years since satellite monitoring began.
Part of what's going on is that it was so darn warm this winter over the Arctic Ocean, especially out on the Atlantic side.
Center officials say the sea ice probably reached its maximum extent on March 7th, when it covered about 5.5 million square miles of the Arctic Ocean, including portions of the Bering Sea that lie south of the Arctic Circle. That's about 470,000 square miles less than the 38-year average, and it's about 37,000 square miles less than the 2015 maximum extent, the previous record-setting low. 2016 set the third lowest maximum extent on record.
This is the third year we've seen these extreme low values of sea ice.
The center says it's been a warm fall and winter for the Arctic Ocean, with temperatures averaging 4.5 degrees Fahrenheit above the norm. The air over the Chukchi Sea northwest of Alaska and the Barents Sea north of Scandinavia was even warmer, averaging 9 degrees above the norm.
And so that prevented sea ice from growing in part, and it looks like we probably got a lot of very thin ice out there right now.
Serez says Arctic sea ice is already beginning to melt and recede, setting the stage for a very low sea ice minimum extent that the center will declare in September.
So we're starting the melt season in a deep hole right now, and we'll see how things work out this spring and summer, but I'm expecting we're going to have another very, very low September extent.
Serez says seasonal weather conditions around the Arctic will determine whether the minimum sea ice extent will set another record. He says the minimum is the more important and telling metric.
That's the one that really matters in the end, and what we're seeing is that September extent is going down quite quickly right now.
Serez says the polar ice cap won't last long if the region continues to warm at this rate.
We are on course sometime in the next few decades, maybe even earlier, to have summers in the Arctic where you go out there at the end of August, say, and there's no ice at all.
He says that means, aside from some scattered icebergs and clusters of pack ice, the view from space in the fall of, say, 2040 will show a blue Arctic Ocean. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Elizabeth Harbaugh, Casey Grove and Ann Hillman in Anchorage, Dan Bross and Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, and Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
When you pick Click Give, you become a partner with a local nonprofit working to protect the things you love about Alaska. Whether it's the arts, our parks, or lending a hand to someone in crisis, with Pick Click Give, it's easy to find a nonprofit that shares your passion or provides programs in your neighborhood. When you apply for your PFD, say yes to sharing just $25 or more of your dividend. If you've already filed, add a donation at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by Pick Click Give.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.